We made it through most of Exodus 13, and we're coming back today. We're picking it up at verse 17, and then a little bit into chapter 14. And as you know, things at this point are really ramping up. The people of Israel, after all of the developments with the plagues, are finally beginning to move out of Egypt. And yet, things are not over by any means. As we come to Exodus 13, 17, we will read that little by little through the message, but let me begin by pointing us to someone that probably we are familiar with, many of us, a famous devotional writer of the 19th and early 20th century. He served as a pastor in South Africa. He wrote famous works on the subject of prayer, as well as on the theme of humility, and a lot of other related topics in the Christian life. His name was Andrew Murray. And I ran across a story about a time when another missionary, also well known, had the opportunity to meet Murray and to get to know him a little bit. Her name was Amy Carmichael. And she tells in one of her books that in 1895, when things were looking very discouraging for her and her ministry, she actually met Murray when he was in England taking part at different conventions that were being held. And here's what she writes. A breakdown in Japan had ended in my return home about that time, and we were both guests in the same house. I knew that his books were very good, not that I had read one of them, but a neat row of them, dressed in sober gray, lived in my mother's room, and she and everybody said how good they were. And the question that she had was this: was he as good as his books? She came to the conclusion he was better. For there was not only goodness, there was a delicious dry humor, dauntless courage, and the gentleness and simplicity of a dear child. And he was very loving. He never seemed to be tired of loving. And then something painful happened. She doesn't express what it is, but some crisis, some discouraging development in Murray's life. And then she shares, this is how he met it. This is how he dealt with that crisis. He was quiet for a while with his Lord, and then he wrote these words for himself. So apparently he shared with her what he put down in his journal. And here's what he wrote. First, he, that is God brought me here. It is by his will I am in this straight place. In that fact, I will rest. Next, he will keep me here in his love and give me grace to behave as his child. Then he will make the trial a blessing, teaching me the lessons he intends me to learn and working in me the grace he means to bestow. Last, in his good time, he can bring me out again. How and when, he knows. So this brother wrote himself a sermon, a four-point sermon, which we have one of those today. And it's like we were talking about in Sunday school. He was preaching to himself. In fact, he had a little summary at the end. He says, let me say I am here, number one, by God's appointment, number two, in his keeping, number three, under his training, and number four, for his time. God put me here. God's going to keep me here. God's going to teach me through this. And God has a timetable for how long this is going to last. Well, that idea of surrender to the sovereign guidance of God is the atmosphere of our passage today. God had brought the Israelites finally out of their slavery by manifesting His power over so many different areas of life and of the supernatural. Those 10 plagues were used of the Lord to bring them out of there in triumph. They have been through so much and have seen so much of Yahweh working on their behalf. But the story has really just begun. We're just into chapter 13. Exodus has 40 chapters. And at this point especially, these people, though they can look back and see so clearly the hand of God in their lives, their minds, I'm sure, are filled with questions about the future, like what next after all of that. There are so many pressing needs and so many threats upon them, individually and corporately. The Israelites are beginning to make their way out of Egypt. They are taking steps out, taking steps forward. But what they need at this point especially is the assurance that God was going to guide them safely to their destination. And that idea of the Lord guiding them sovereignly, safely to their destination, that is what our passage today dwells on. The title of the message this morning is this: Initial Lessons on God's Leading. This is how the Lord, in the first stages of their journey, was directing them step by step into the unexpected and demonstrating the wisdom of His leadership. Initial lessons on God's leading. And some of these lessons are going to be rather unsettling, because on the surface they don't look like God knows what He's doing and the choices that He's making and how He's guiding them. But when you back off and look at how all of this is working together, you really do find that your faith, and their faith hopefully, is being strengthened. And this passage is here to build confidence in the Lord's wise and sovereign and gracious guidance of His people. And we see here four lessons about His leading. Number one, in the first couple of verses here, God's guidance, His leading, accounts for His people's weakness. God's leading accounts for His people's weakness. Those of us who have been called to leadership, we have perhaps learned some things along the way and perhaps getting more wise, but we cannot predict the future. And we cannot predict whether a choice that we make to lead our families, to lead whomever, is taking into consideration all of the factors that have a bearing on the issue at hand. Whether good results that might happen if we go a certain route, or negative results that might happen if we go another route, we can do our best to observe patterns and to look ahead, but we are so limited in our ability to say for sure this is the right way because of this or that or other factor that's going to unfold as we go down this path. In the case of the Lord, He knows all the factors. He knows all the variables. He knows all the contingencies. He knows what's going to happen in the future. And what we find in this passage is that one of the factors He takes into consideration is actually, the way we would put it, is how much His people can handle. God's leading accounts for His people's weakness. Let's read verses 17 and 18. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, lest the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. But God led the people around by the way of the wilderness, toward the Red Sea. And the people of Israel went up out of the land of Egypt equipped for battle. Here we find the first reference to God's guidance of these people, but it is a negative point as to something God did not lead them to do. God's decisions about where He doesn't take His people, as well as where He does. And what I want to say is that those decisions about where He doesn't take His people are just as much a part of His leading as where He does take them. You look at the map and what is being described here, and humanly speaking, God did not do what would have been the most logical thing. Because humanly speaking, the most logical way to exit and to get into Canaan was through a well-known trade route that is known as the Great Trunk Road, but more commonly known as the Via Maris in Latin, which means the way of the sea. And it's talking about the way that goes right alongside, parallel to, the Mediterranean Sea. And it started down at the Egyptian city of Heliopolis. It went up the Mediterranean most of the way through what we would call Canaan, kept going up that coast to a certain point, and then turned east toward Damascus in Syria. And it was the most reasonable, the most humanly wise approach to get into Canaan from Egypt. Somebody has estimated that had they gone that way, they would have entered Canaan in about 2 weeks. But the Lord said, we're not going to do the most logical thing. We're not going to do the most efficient things. Some of us thrive on efficiency. And we like to have all our ducks in a row and find the best logical way from point A to point B. And sometimes God works that way, but often He does not. Instead of doing the most efficient thing, He takes them out of the way, down a more complicated path, and toward a more risky path. The way not of the sea, the Mediterranean Sea, but actually the way of the desert. The Lord often works that way. In our pilgrimage, in God's thinking, there are more important considerations than human logic. What makes sense to us? There are more important considerations than efficiency. And what was the reason in this case? Actually, initially, you might find it a little bit confusing. There's a little bit of a tension when you compare one statement in verse 17 to another statement at the end of verse 18. Verse 17 says, "Lest the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt." But verse 18 says, "And the people of Israel went out of the land of Egypt equipped for battle." So it's like he's saying they're going to be overwhelmed if they face war, but then this other statement says they're actually ready for war, equipped to battle. Well, this is one case where, and I don't do this often, I would recommend a different translation of that expression in verse 18. And you can see this as you compare with other Bible versions. This does not say that they had weapons and they had been highly trained and a lot of experience in warfare. These people were builders, and before that they were shepherds, right? These were not trained soldiers. Israel did not have a standing army. The New King James Version, for example, says that they went out in orderly ranks, or the Christian Standard Bible says they went out in battle formation. It's not talking about them having weapons, it's talking about they were organized. And to look at these people in blocks of folks who are marching forward, they looked like they were going to a battle, but that doesn't mean that they were actually ready to fight. In fact, the term here seems to refer to being organized in groups of 50 people. So Moses or somebody helped them get organized. You can imagine with how large this nation was that it would have taken some wisdom to figure out how can we all, you know, keep going together and make progress and not slow down, not get bogged down. So they had some organization. but they are not outfitted for battle. In fact, verse 17 says the reason God doesn't lead them up the coast is that going up that way, they would immediately end up in the territory of the Philistines. Now, you know that name because the Philistines, for hundreds of years after this, continue to be a thorn in the side of the people of Israel. And again, we can identify these general areas on the map. As you think about news that you hear today regarding the Middle East, we hear often about the Palestinian territories and cities like Gaza and all these rockets that keep getting shot back and forth between Israel and Gaza. That area is precisely where these Israelites were going to be traveling through if they went up the way of the sea. And the forerunners of the Palestinians were the Philistines. And they would not be keen to let these outsiders in. And they were also experienced soldiers and would surely attack the people of God while they were vulnerable. Now somebody says, so what? Isn't the Lord able to empower the Israelites to defeat the Philistines? And didn't he do these amazing things to humble this mighty power of Egypt? And wasn't he going to empower them, even though they still didn't have a lot of experience, in the next generation to defeat the Canaanites? Of course, the Lord is able to empower his people at whatever stage they happen to be, to do whatever he calls upon them to do. But what we see here is something of his special care for these people, a special concern for their frailty at this early stage of the journey. He knew that a military conflict would overwhelm them with fear and with discouragement. And so he chooses to take them another way. It's like these people at this stage, they're in kindergarten. He is not going to give them a graduate level exam this early in the process. And as history unfolds, you become aware of the fact that this was a legitimate concern that God had. I want to read to you from the account of what took place 40 years later. Even after what's going to happen at the Red Sea, even after all the miracles in the desert, the Lord takes them up to the borders of the Promised Land. And what not happened 40 years later, actually shortly after that, that led to 40 years in the wilderness. Here's what Numbers 14 says. After they send the spies in, then all the congregation raised a loud cry, and the people wept that night. And all the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The whole congregation said to them, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us unto this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become a prey. Would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt?" And they said to one another, "Let us choose a leader and go back to Egypt." So the Lord knows what he's talking about. That certainly right out of the gate of Egypt, if that was the first thing that they run up against, that the temptation was going to be, this is a failed enterprise. Forget about this. Being a slave was better. Let's go back to Egypt. That's exactly what happened when those people now were supposed to be ready to conquer the land. And folks, I want to say that the Lord knows what he's talking about, what he's doing when in his providence he takes each of us down unexpected paths or into situations that seem like a detour in our lives, that don't seem to make any sense, that don't seem to make a good use of our time or our abilities. When something like that happens in your life, I encourage you to think about this passage and to consider the possibility that the Lord may actually, through that, be keeping you from some greater problem. That He may be protecting you from some greater suffering. Maybe God has shut the door on some relationship or some job or some position or some other thing that you really wanted and that made a lot of sense and that would seem to be the next logical step in your life. But He shut the door. And the door that He has left open to you does not seem particularly appealing. Does not seem to be a good use of your time or your energies. The reality is you do not know what actually stands behind the closed door. God may well be protecting you from circumstances that would crush you. And part of trusting Him and following His leadership includes submissively walking away from doors that He has closed, as well as following Him through doors that He has opened. God's leading of His people accounts for their weakness. Now, it can certainly be a challenge to trust in the Lord about that when we don't know the future and we don't know all that He's thinking. But what we find in the next short little verse that seems like a passing comment in verse 19, what we find is designed to help us to keep trusting this God we sometimes don't understand. And as we look at verse 19, what we find is that God's guidance reflects His faithfulness. So number one, God's guidance accounts for His people's weakness. Number two, it reflects His faithfulness. Look at verse 19 with me. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for Joseph had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones with you from here. That short comment, it seems kind of random. It seems kind of irrelevant. I mean, you understand that this was a request or a command that Joseph had given. But why stop to make that point when so many other things were up in the air and you want to find out what takes place? Actually, I think it has everything to do with this idea of trusting the leadership of God. It quotes the deathbed words of Joseph that are recorded in Genesis 50 and verse 25. That was about 400 years before the Exodus. And when Joseph is dying, even though he was convinced of the providence of God that had brought him to Egypt and that had used him to deliver his family, Joseph also knew that that was not their home. He knew that God had made certain promises to his great-grandfather Abraham. And they're very specifically stated in Genesis 15, 13 to 16. God said that the Israelites would be in Egypt a long time. But He made it clear that that was temporary, that the Lord had something else for them, that He had promised the land of Canaan to them. And on his deathbed, Joseph is affirming his faith in God's promise and something that looks so far away and irrelevant to him. I mean, after all, he's going to be dead. What does he care? On his deathbed, he makes this great affirmation. It's like he's saying, this land of Egypt has been very good to me. It has been very good to us. But it is still not our land. God promised us a different land. That's where I want to go, even if it is only to get buried. Get me out of here when you leave. And so after all of these centuries, the word was passed on generation after generation. We may leave all kinds of things behind, but we cannot leave Joseph's bones behind. Our patriarch gave us orders that he did not belong to this place. And that was an act of faith. I have one reason that I'm calling that an act of faith, a statement of faith. I don't think I would need a proof text, but I actually do have one. Because Hebrews 11:22 says, by faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave directions concerning his bones. The Lord interpreted that deathbed statement and command as an act of faith. It wasn't just a matter of national identity. It wasn't a personal preference about where he happened to want to be buried. This was a matter of faith in a very specific promise of God. Now, as it turned out, those bones would have to wait another 40 years to actually get buried. We don't read the end of this little account until you get to the end of the book of Joshua. After the conquest, Joshua 24:32 says this, as for the bones of Joseph, which the people of Israel brought up from Egypt, they buried them at Shechem, in the piece of land that Jacob bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of money. It became an inheritance to the descendant of Joseph. Some of you have burial plots that you have purchased. Here this family purchased this plot way back in the days of the patriarchs. And what a blessing that even though so much time had passed, we have this little record. It's just one statement, but Joseph got what he asked for. And he was put there, his body was, right next to his ancestors. However long it took, this man was persuaded that God was going to keep his word. And he made plans way in advance to participate, even if only in his burial. He wanted to participate in the fulfillment of the promise. So as the people of Israel start to make their way down what would be a long and tortuous path to the promised land, they had right there among them this vivid image that their God could be trusted. And I don't know how this worked or how many people saw this. I kind of think about these scenes that we have observed this week of these masses of people standing for a whole day to get just a little glimpse at the Queen's casket. For whatever reason, they want to lay their eyes on that. Take in the moment. It means something special to them. Here, this mummy was being carried around all through the desert wanderings of the people of Israel. And if anybody should lay an eye on it or think about it, that was a declaration very graphically of how serious God was about his promises and what faith looks like. You don't even give up on God's promises, not even when you die. The death does not somehow undermine the faithfulness of God. The very fact of that mummy being carried around is a witness to the reliability of the promises of God. Well, I'm not recommending that you have a mummy in your house. And I'm not saying anything about where you should be buried. But surely, each of us has memories, and we have other people who have gone before, and we have the Bible full of records of these people of faith that become to us moving witnesses to the reliability of the character and the promises of God. And I'll put it this way, as I read what happened here and what I believe was the lesson for the people of Israel at this time, we ought to learn to soak up from these heroes of the faith and from the stories of God's working in the past. We ought to learn to soak up from them the spiritual energy that we need to keep pressing forward, trusting the Lord in our generation. When we don't understand the future, how God is going to carry us through what lies ahead, we can at least look back and we can see, we can observe, we can reflect on everything that He has brought us through and all that these other people of faith are witnessing to regarding the faithfulness of God. The Lord's guidance reflects His faithfulness. And yet there is even more here that God intends to use from this passage to strengthen our faith. And so we move on to the last few verses of chapter 13. And here's what we see there. God's guidance comes with and through His presence. Let me say that again. God's guidance comes with and through His presence. We read about His presence in what we call a theophany. That's a visible manifestation of the presence of God, starting at verse 20. It says, "And they moved on from Succoth and encamped at Etham on the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, that they might travel by day and by night. The pillar of cloud by day, the pillar of fire by night did not depart from before the people." That account is so well placed at this point because things are going to get pretty shaky in the immediate future. It's well placed because what lies immediately ahead could easily have made these people feel like God had walked away. Like He had given up. Like He had run out of steam, like He didn't care anymore, like He had abandoned them. And we can understand why they would struggle that way. When you're out in the desert and you're facing impossible circumstances, in this case, the Lord graciously chose to put right in front of their eyes an undeniable, inescapable, visible and even felt evidence that God was present with them, that even though there are all of these fearful circumstances, He was actually right there, presently and in front of them. They could look directly on a supernatural manifestation of the presence of God. At night, it took the form of a column of fire that illuminated the sky and enabled them to travel no matter what time it was. During the day, it took the form of a massive column of smoke. He never abandoned them. He was clearly, visibly right there in their midst. In fact, whenever He chose to move the column from one place to another, that was the signal that it was time for them to move as well. So His special presence and His guidance, they went together. They were inseparably linked. In fact, it was that theophany that was the means the Lord used to guide them forward. You could think of it this way. The Lord didn't stay up in heaven and just shout down orders or throw down pieces of paper telling Moses what to do next. He was actually taking this journey with them. He was right there. He was like a hiking guide or a military scout, showing them where to go by staying just a few steps in front of them. But He was always within visible distance. Now we look at that and we say, what an amazing experience these people had. And what an assuring thing that would have been to them when they faced all the crisis. But then we think about the application to our lives and we say, well, that was great for them, but I've never seen a pillar of cloud. I've never experienced the pillar of fire. God has never guided me in those ways. He's never made it that obvious, that visible, that felt. In fact, often I feel like I'm in the dark. I wish the Lord would show up in this way and clear things up for me. It's true that we don't have these kinds of theophanies, that that's not the way the Lord tends to work in our day. But folks, if we accept the testimony of the Bible, what we would have to conclude is that we actually have things better than these people did. That the point of history, of redemptive history that we live in by God's providence, there is a greater reality that we experience that actually that cloud was just pointing ahead toward. The Bible refers to all those kinds of things as shadows. And what we have today as the substance, those are the signs, the pointers. We live in the reality. We don't need a pillar of cloud and fire to assure us of the presence of God because we live on this side of Emmanuel, God with us. In fact, John 1 takes up some of this imagery and says about Jesus that the Word became flesh and He tabernacled among us. He is the fulfillment of that glory that eventually descended right on the place of worship. Jesus is the manifestation, the highest manifestation in history of the glory and the presence of God. And we live on this side of that. And you say, true, but Jesus went up to heaven. And you know what Jesus said about that in John 14:6? I will ask the Father, John 14:16, I will ask the Father and He will give you another helper to be with you forever. And the Spirit of God that we're talking about in Sunday school, He has come, sent by the ascended Christ, to take on the same kinds of roles in the people of God that Jesus had in the lives of His original disciples. Instructing them, comforting them, directing them, encouraging them, moving them forward. Jesus has not only given us the marching orders, right? Like we find, for example, in the Great Commission in Matthew 28. But He has also said this, again, inseparably linked with that commission. He says, behold, I am with you always to the end of the age. And that might be the assurance that somebody here needs today. You know the Lord is guiding you, but where He's guiding you fills you with fear. And it just freaks you out because of the uncertainty and the catastrophe that seems to be impending. What we're reading here is the Lord doesn't just guide us, like, go there, do that, do this. The Lord is always present with you in the carrying out of His guidance. He is there by your side. His presence is ever faithful, never failing to comfort you, to sustain you, to enable you. We see that illustrated here, and this is the same promise that the Lord extends to His people under the new covenant as well. God's guidance comes with and through His people. In fact, what is the new covenant? I mentioned this, I think, last week in our class. It's about the Lord, the Spirit, actually takes up residence inside of the believer. So close, so real is the presence that He actually lives within us. That is the way that this principle is worked out in this age. Now, we're going to end by looking at a few verses here in chapter 14. And it brings us to the question, why? With all of these sometimes strange things that God does, why is it that He guides His people the way He does? And what I want to say is this. This is the point of verses 1 to 4, that God's guidance aims at His glory. That's the objective he's ultimately after. God's leadership in our lives, it aims at his own glory as the chief thing. Exodus 14. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Tell the people of Israel to turn back and encamp in front of Pi-Hahiroth between Migdol and the sea in front of Baal-Zephon. You shall encamp facing it by the sea, for Pharaoh will say of the people of Israel, 'They are wandering in the land, the wilderness has shut them in, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, and the Egyptians shall know that I am Yahweh,' and they did so." You see the emphasis there on this is all leading to the glory of God. Now, if we thought that God's original choice to go the way of the wilderness didn't make sense, this one here really doesn't make sense. And again, you'd have to look at a map to see this and how the Lord was directing them. They had already made some progress toward the wilderness, and now he basically tells them to turn around, to go back in the direction that they came from, and specifically to a point where the Red Sea was on one side of them. That would effectively trap them if an enemy should attack them. In fact, somebody has said that this would be like the Lord guiding these people into a cul-de-sac. What are you going to do in a situation like that if some mighty army is standing at the entrance of the cul-de-sac? Pharaoh would have heard about this move, because there were towers and cities spread throughout this region, and so through the sentinels that were posted along the way, he would hear about their weird travel route. And it would look to him like they were aimlessly wandering around, like they got scared of the desert or had second thoughts or couldn't figure out what to do next. And as if that weren't bad enough, on top of everything else, the Lord says, "You know what? I think I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart just like one more time." And through the Lord's working in that man's heart, and despite of all the losses that Pharaoh had suffered, and you talk about a guy doing something illogical, like somehow he really thought he could get away with this, he decides he's going to go after the Israelites and try to subdue them and bring them back to slavery. It's like, why would the Lord do such a thing? Changing things all of a sudden, taking them back to a place of danger. What was his purpose? It's the same purpose, folks, that God has said again and again for all of these things he had been doing. "I will get glory over Pharaoh, and the Egyptians will know that I am Yahweh." What would be a terrifying experience for Israel was a means by which their God was demonstrating once again his supremacy and getting glory to himself and showing them that he could really be trusted. It sounds to me a little bit like when Jesus knew that Lazarus was dying, and he deliberately holds off and waits until he dies. And people were like, he loved him, he could have done something to heal him, he let him die. And when he does show up, he says to Martha, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" And she did see that glory as Jesus brought her brother back to life. And actually, it sounds even more like the cross of Jesus, which looked like a total disaster, a defeat of the Messiah. And yet, right there in John, a little bit later in chapter 12, in talking about the cross, he says, "Father, glorify your name." The great moment of glorifying God has come, and it's going to be through my death and what looks like a tragedy. And the Lord says, "I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again." God's guidance of Israel to the Red Sea, it looked like sure defeat, just like the crucifixion did. But both of those seemingly illogical decisions gave the Lord unparalleled opportunities to put his might and his wisdom on display. And he's saying that's actually the goal here. I ran across a book that a preacher wrote that's called The Red Sea Rules. And it's on Exodus 14. I might share a little bit of that some more next week. But on this point, he said this. The next time you're overwhelmed, instead of asking, how can I get out of this mess? Try asking, how can God be glorified in this situation? One's perspective is entirely changed by the spiritual realities behind that approach. It's like switching on floodlights in a dark stadium. Change the question in how you're looking at it. Not how can I get out of this mess, but how can God be glorified? Part of faith in God's guidance in our lives is just accepting that His purpose is not my immediate comfort. It is not to satisfy my sense of logic or to do what would make me feel good. Faith includes embracing the Lord's bigger and better purpose, which is His glory. And what we find when the Lord does glorify Himself is that actually that is what ultimately satisfies our own soul too. So we look back on this passage and we've seen that God's guidance accounts for His people's weakness. It reflects His faithfulness. It comes with and through His presence. And it aims at His glory. And all of that is intended to deepen our trust in Him as He guides us in our lives as well. And it's very encouraging that at least at this point, not to speak of what happens later, but at least at this point, the people of Israel are just a wonderful model of that kind of trust. Do you notice how the passage ends? It's very succinctly, but they go through all this and God gives them these orders and it just says, and they did so. And they did so. They accepted His wisdom. They took the step of faith. And that's the spirit the Lord is nurturing in us as well. It's the spirit of trust, of submissiveness that's going to be reflected in our closing hymn in just a moment, which is entitled, Guide Me, O Thou Great Jehovah. You may know that it was written by a man named William Williams, who lived in the 18th century. And he came to be known as the father of Welsh hymnody. Though I'm thankful that it was translated into English, because I don't know Welsh. But it struck me as I read a little bit about Williams, how appropriate of a song this was, even for his own life, because for over 40 years, he was an itinerant preacher in Wales, and he zigzagged the country, going from place to place, proclaiming the gospel. And you look at that, if you could read his journal or just kind of see a map of all the places he went, it may have looked like he was just wandering all over the countryside, aimlessly going from here to there without very much planning. And yet, it was under the perfect guidance of the God that Williams worshiped. And this hymn is also appropriate because as we go through it, you'll see that Williams is pulling on different incidents of the people of Israel through these kinds of circumstances as a way of helping us express our confidence in the all-wise leadership of God. This song has taken on great significance, particularly for the United Kingdom. It is often sung at formal gatherings of the monarchy. It was sung at the funeral of Princess Diana. It was sung at the wedding of William and Kate. I wouldn't be surprised if it's sung at the Queen's funeral tomorrow. I just wish these folks truly understood the realities that are here and of the promises and the assurance that the Lord extends to those who are truly trusting in Him through Jesus Christ. And I pray that we can sing this from our hearts. It's number 495. And Brian's going to come to lead us.
Let's stand and sing, Guide Me, O Thou Great Jehovah.